The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Hi, everyone. My name is Phelan Oliver, and I'm back this week to tell you that August is National Support Black Businesses Month. Were you aware of that? Because I was not. August is also my birthday month. Shout out to Virgos. I'm a late August baby, so. This month actually traces its history back to 2004 when Frederick Jordan, an engineering entrepreneur, teamed up with John William Templeton, president and executive editor at E-Access Corp., to start a yearly event. Frederick Jordan felt compelled to highlight and uplift other Black business owners after he took some time to realize that there was a lot of challenges and obstacles in his way of being a Black business owner. According to the United States Census report, Black-owned businesses account for 9.4% of all firms, which is still below the 13.1% of Black U.S. adult population. But representing 10% of all minority-owned businesses are Black women. The census also revealed that 59% of Black-owned businesses are operated by women. According to an article from the National Geographic, the COVID-19 outbreak disproportionately hurt minority-owned businesses. Black-owned businesses were especially affected. They found that 41% of Black-owned businesses had been shut down due to the pandemic, compared to the 17% of white-owned businesses that were affected. A lot of times people will give me information like this and I'm like, okay, but how do I help? How can I do this? And I don't really have time to look into it and blah, blah, blah. You guys have time to look into it, but I'm going to give you some resources. So in the month of August, you can shop local. There are a list of different directories that you can Google, but here are a few, and I will also leave links in the show notes. You can go to a directory called We Buy Black. Another one is called Where You Come From. Another one you could go to is literally just called Support Black Owned, and it's a directory. And then there's also an official Black Wall Street directory. And then for food, there's a directory called Eat Okra. And I believe it was in South Carolina, they started Black Food Fridays, where they would get their curbside food to go or dine out or whatever the case may be, whatever they were doing during the pandemic. They would pick up their food from Black-owned businesses. And so Eat Okra is a great resource to find Black-owned restaurants in your area. But also use Google. Google is a great resource to find anything at this point. But Google has also been adding new ways to help users find and support Black-owned businesses. Last July, U.S. merchants with a verified Google business profile could add a Black-owned business label to their profile so customers could see that they were Black-owned and that they were easily able to find them via Google search or maps. And then recently, Google decided to extend the label, the Black-owned label, to the site's shopping tab so that people can easily find Black-owned products. Going back to other ways that you can support, according to the Huffington Post, 20% of car repair and maintenance shops are Black-owned. So if you need an oil change, you can definitely use Google to find a local Black-owned maintenance shop. You can follow hashtags, hashtag support Black business, hashtag Black-owned, hashtag National Black Business Month. Those are just a few that you could follow and try to see if you could find Black businesses via those hashtags. Social media is always a great place to start as well. You could also, if you are a small business yourself, partner with a Black-owned business. maybe offer a special offer between the two of you, or maybe a project between the two of you, just so that you can amplify and just, you know, collaborate with a Black-owned business. And then another way that you can be helpful this month is holding other vendors accountable, making sure that you see diversity at your local farmers market, just making sure other local organizations are being more inclusive. Also, you can make space for Black people in general. It's a great time during this Black liberation to make space for Black people, because, you know, education is important. Knowledge is power. We all are understanding things that we maybe didn't have an understanding of before. And so now that we know that there are systems in place that have been holding people back for generations, now is a great time to use your privilege, use your platform to amplify other voices. So that could be, you know, passing the mic on your social media if you have, you know, a decent following. And I think that's a great way to network in general right now is, one, because we are in the middle of a pandemic. So instead of going to networking events, it's just allowing someone to take over your social media for one day so that they can network with your audience is actually a really small but significant way to help. So those are just a few ideas. I will link a lot of this in the show notes. I hope this was helpful. I hope this was new knowledge for you, or if you didn't know something, you learned something today. And yeah, thanks for tuning in with me. If you'd like to follow me on my social media, I am at Phalen Oliver. It's P as in Peter, H-A-L-I-N. Oliver on Instagram, and I will see you all soon.
Hi friends, Emma Ito here, pronouns she, her, hers. I hope you guys are having a great day, a great night. Hopefully you're getting some relaxing in as you listen to this podcast. I'm here to also remind you to drink water and remind myself to drink water. Before I get into this segment, I do want to give a bit of a content trigger warning. I will be talking a lot about the opioid epidemic, as well as addiction and just a lot that has to do with the opioid crisis. So please be gentle with yourself going into this segment. So this segment, I am going to be talking about a book I recently finished that just kind of blew my mind. It is called Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty by Patrick Radden Keefe, who's the author of Say Nothing. And maybe some of you all have seen this book. I had seen it earlier this year on Bookstagram, and I kind of hesitated to pick it up because it's a very large book. It is 434 pages, and I was a little intimidated by it. And now, that being said, I have now read 110 books this year, and this is absolutely in my top five. It's just a really impressive piece of investigative journalism. And the story revolves around three generations of the Sackler family. And prior to reading this, I had only really remembered the Sackler name being attached to what is now renamed, I believe, the Freer and Sackler Galleries of Asian Art at the Smithsonian. They also have their name on the walls of many institutions, such as Harvard, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Oxford, and the Louvre. This family is extremely famous for their philanthropy, but their fortune was actually built by Valium, and their reputation was destroyed by OxyContin. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some pieces that stuck out to me in this book, and then I'm going to kind of go into a feminist lens as far as the opioid epidemic and things that kind of I was thinking of as I was reading this. And yeah, this book is very powerful. It will make you furious. It shows very clearly how intricately wed the United States has been to capitalism, and how those in power, those with money, uphold the wealthy and continue to uphold the wealthy. And it really shows the marketing tactics and the history of the development of Valium as well as how all of the templates that were used for Marketing Valium were later used to launch OxyContin. So the book itself is split up into three parts. It's split up into Book 1, Patriarch, Book 2, Dynasty, and Book 3, Legacy. And it really starts with the history of three doctor brothers, Raymond, Mortimer, and Arthur Sackler, who I'm going to talk a little bit about. And these were three brothers who weathered the poverty of the Great Depression and anti-Semitism. And Arthur worked at a mental institution, and this was a time that mental institutions were really terrible places. And Arthur felt that he saw a better way in conducting research into drug treatments. And he was also a very, very good marketer. And the marketing tactics that he created really paved the way, as I mentioned, to launch OxyContin. And this family really was the dynasties really were the creators of the opioid crisis, which is especially clear after reading this book. So Arthur, he was the first one in the family who started to build their family's fortune. And he purchased a drug manufacturer, Purdue Frederick, which would be run by Raymond and Mortimer. And as they began making more and more money, the brothers also began collecting art and these beautiful, gigantic homes. And their children and their grandchildren grew up in this extremely luxurious life. So Arthur's first major drugs that he began to market with his company, Purdue Pharma, were two tranquilizers, actually, a drug called Librium and a drug that many of us are probably familiar with hearing the name of, Valium. Arthur went on a number of advertising campaigns that would go straight to doctors to try and persuade doctors that Valium and other drugs like it had very few side effects, they weren't addictive, and they could cure all number of different afflictions. And I just thought that was so striking because I remember growing up with so many, you know, toothpaste commercials, for example, that's like, this is dentist recommended. Well, Arthur Sackler was the first person to really start doing something like this. And another thing that he specifically did was he enlisted sales representatives. So there are people that worked for the company that created Valium, and they went across the country and into rural areas, into cities, with doctors and nurses and pharmacists to persuade them to buy and use, prescribe these drugs. And that all was a template, which is all used later, again, as I said, with the launch of OxyContin, with many other drugs that we see now. Another piece that I wanted to throw in that I thought was, I had never known, and I actually spoke to some of my older historian colleagues who were just like, yes, I definitely remember the history of this, is that when Valium first was launched in the 1960s, women were actually advertised to much more than men for Valium. And I'm going to quote a little section on page 58 of this book. In describing an ideal patient, a typical ad for Valium read 35, single, and psychoneurotic. An early ad for Librium showed a young woman with an armful of books and suggested that even the routine stress of heading off to college might be best addressed with Librium. But the truth was, Librium and Valium were marketed using such a variety of gendered mid-century tropes. The neurotic singleton, the frazzled housewife, the joyless career woman, the menopausal shrew. That, as historian Andrea Tone noted in her book, The Age of Anxiety, what Roche's tranquilizers seemed to offer was a quick fix for the problem of, quote, being female, end quote. Interesting, too, because when I did talk to my my historian colleagues about this book, they told me they remembered Valium as being marketed as mommy's little helper, and that it was a drug that was often especially marketed to women. And essentially with Valium and Librium, which are, again, as I said, both tranquilizers that were launched in the 60s, they were prescribed using these strategies that Sackler had used. And Librium actually was the most prescribed drug in America until it was overtaken by Valium in 1968. And even then, it still remained in the top five. And by 1964, 22 million prescriptions were written for Valium. And by 1975, that reached 60 million, and Valium was the first $100 million drug in history. which is just totally wild. I mean, we're talking about the 60s and we're talking about Valium. And then I'm going to skip forward a little because, as I said, this is a very long book and I'm not going to go into every single detail of it, but that family continued to use all of these tactics and invent new tactics as far as selling drugs. And Purdue Pharma first released OxyContin in 1996. So Arthur Sackler did pass away before it was released. He died in 1987, but his family continued to use the lessons learned by Arthur. And one of the things that Patrick Radden Keefe discovers pretty much immediately is that by 1997, there are indications that OxyContin was being abused. People were being addicted, people were overdosing and dying, and that there is a black market in the drug. So not even a year, and that was already happening. And what we see is that those same marketing tactics Arthur used for Valium were also used by the later generations of the Sackler family with OxyContin. On top of, they were co-opting doctors, they were influencing the FDA and then paying inside people to fast-track FDA approval. They were consistently downplaying the drug's addictiveness and continued to deny that this drug was not addictive, that it was safe to use, even though privately they knew that it was not. And the family themselves consistently avoided accountability and evaded accountability, and they continue to. So in this book, Keith, let me just do a little bit of an aside. The sources he used were incredible. I started this book on audio, and I knew, especially as a historian, that I wanted to get in and look at his sources. And the endnotes are just extremely detailed. He said in the audiobook he actually had a trusted journalist check every single one of his endnotes and references. And he also got a number of interviews, like really personal inside interviews with people who had worked at Purdue Pharma. He used legal documents. There were a number of court cases that have gone on throughout this history, as it's talked about, and that are continuing to this day. And he also had some personal emails from the Sacklers that talk about how the family micromanaged the company, showing that they knew exactly what their product was doing. So it's just a very impressive book. And I was just really blown away by every single one of his endnotes. So if you're an endnote person like me, then this is definitely something you might want in hard copy. There are a few things I want to mention about the opioid crisis, and again, just thoughts I kind of had, especially from a feminist lens as I was reading. But, you know, 4 out of 5 heroin addicts start out by misusing prescription opioids. And I am 31. So if you are around my age or older, then you will remember a time when doctors really prescribed Oxy like it was candy. I mean, I got my wisdom teeth out and I remember them giving me way, way more Oxy than I ended up using. And, you know, I think that has changed significantly now. And I will talk a little bit about the court cases, the most recent court cases. But, you know, that is something that's even in my lifetime. I'm still pretty young, I like to think. So that is something I still remember very well. And even though OxyContin is not the only prescription opioid, that without these marketing deceptions that Keefe talks about in the book, it's likely we wouldn't have an opioid crisis. And so, as I mentioned earlier, the Sacklers did all of these tactics that they just keep getting away with it, and they just kept getting away with it. And essentially, they even courted public officials who were tasked with the oversight of their products. So, for example, Curtis Wright, who was the FDA official responsible for approving OxyContin, he actually ended up working for the company about a year after leaving public service. And, you know, he said that he took a year off and, like, he wasn't ever working for the Sacklers, but it didn't take him long to get to working for Purdue Pharma for a very significant salary. So that was something that is shown in the book. And the first federal official who attempted to take Purdue to court for the abuse potential of their star product was Jay McCloskey of Maine. And he actually stepped down from his prosecutor's post in 2001 and ended up working as a consultant for Purdue. So there's a lot of like really icky pieces like that where you're just like, oh, okay, that's interesting. You know, this huge company that has millions and millions of dollars, not just from OxyContin, but also from the fortune that Arthur created with Valium and Librium. And on top of that, they had a number of essentially friends in high places. And so the first serious efforts to bring Purdue to court came out of Virginia, which I am a Virginian. I live in Virginia. I'm talking to you from Virginia. And I never knew this. So this was also really interesting to me. It actually came out of Abington, Virginia, which I've actually been to a number of times. It's really beautiful, more rural, definitely some mountains out there. And it was out of the office of the United States Attorney John Brownlee in 2006. He wrote a 100-page memo that accused Purdue Pharma with, quote, an incendiary catalog of corporate malfeasance and intended to charge them with crimes of money laundering, wire fraud, and mail fraud. This was after a 5-year investigation. And Purdue Pharma LP was convicted of illegally misbranding their pain medication OxyContin. And Purdue and the three executives did admit in this court case that Purdue had fraudulently marketed Oxy by falsely claiming that OxyContin was less addictive, less subject to abuse, and less likely to cause withdrawal symptoms than other pain medications when there was no medical research to support these claims and without Food and Drug Administration approval of these claims. The company and the executives were meant to pay over $634 million in fines, and the executives are placed on 3 years probation and ordered to perform 400 hours of community service. However, $634 million in fines. This is from a company that has made millions and millions and millions of dollars off of OxyContin, off of Valium, off of, at the time in the 60s, Librium. And so this settlement, it was one of the largest financial penalties ever imposed on a drug company, but the way I see it is $634 million in fines to a company like that was probably a very small amount. And even though that was one of the largest financial penalties for a drug company, their Purdue lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, pressured them, and Brownlee, the United States attorney, ended up agreeing to modify the prosecution so that Purdue Pharma's holding company, Purdue Frederick, would plead to a single misbranding charge so that Purdue Pharma would not have a criminal conviction on their name, which would prevent them from doing business with the U.S. government. Brownlee also gave Purdue Pharma immunity from further prosecution up to and for future offenses after this plea deal, continuing until 2007. And the company did continue to sell OxyContin without restriction after their conviction. I did mention Rudy Giuliani's name, but the Sacklers, who were major Republican donors, also had the support of Mary Jo White, who was formerly in charge of the Southern District of New York, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, as well as, obviously, very high-priced legal talent. So as I said, Purdue was agreed to pay $600 million to resolve the felony charge of misleading and defrauding physicians and consumers, and the three executives of the company entered guilty pleas and agreed to $34.5 million in penalties. However, none of these individuals criminally charged were the actual Sacklers. There are a number of articles that talk about how this was a political outcome that Purdue bought. And the company actually named its in-house law library after one of the designated offenders and paid millions in post-employment compensation. John Brownlee, the federal prosecutor for Virginia, ended up clashing over the disposition of the case. And there was word spread that Brownlee's job tenure was shaky, and he resigned in April 2008. In the book, Keefe did interview Brownlee and Rick Mountcastle, the Lyme prosecutor and the career lawyer who handled the case. Mountcastle is still at the Department of Justice, and he raised the possibility that Purdue had an inside man at the FDA who enabled Oxy in exchange for the prospect of future employment, who I mentioned earlier, Curtis's name. And as I was searching through news pieces for Virginia, as of July 2021, Virginia is set to receive at least $80 million from Purdue Pharma. And this was a part of a pending agreement between 15 states and Purdue Pharma, which was an agreement that the states decided to drop their opposition to the company's bankruptcy reorganization plan in exchange for the company's release of millions of documents and agreement to a larger settlement from the family that runs the company. It was a more than $4.3 billion agreement that will hopefully resolve thousands of opioid cases from a Richmond Times-Dispatch news article. And that would include a lawsuit that the Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring filed in 2018 in Tazewell County, which is here in Virginia. Richmond Times-Dispatch did report that a majority of Virginia's portion of the money is going to go to the state's Opioid Abatement Authority, which was a fund Herring asked the legislator to create this year in 2021 to support the treatment and recovery of those who have been addicted to opioids. As far as Virginia, there have been 12,315 opioid overdose deaths in Virginia from 2007 to 2020. And by the numbers, opioids have killed more than 450,000 in the U.S. in two decades. And just to throw that out there, substance use disorders in the United States disproportionately affect minorities and socially vulnerable populations, particularly at those at the intersection of racial and sexual minority status. And I found some really interesting articles, too, on the impacts of men and women and transgender and non-binary people. And, for example, by 2014, women outpaced men in opioid-related hospitalizations in all but 11 states and the District of Columbia, according to findings from the Agency for Health Research and Quality. And I was looking on some peer-reviewed papers on the National Library of Medicine on PubMed that talk a little bit about the primary reason for prescribing opioids is to treat pain. And historically, women have more acute and chronic pain and have been prescribed these drugs in significantly greater numbers than men. And also think about what I said earlier about how Valium was specifically marketed to women. There was a study, though, that talked about the comparison of women and men with chronic pain and did show that women received the majority of prescription opioids and that the use of these medications became a major pathway to misuse and addiction for women. Not just in the United States, as many of us know, have opioids been a problem as well. I found some research on British Columbia and the impacts of opioids on women and men. And I read about was mentioning specifically that statistics alone obviously obscure the gender dimensions of the overdose crisis, which really are largely underexamined and underreported, including the varied ways that women, transgender, two-spirit, and non-binary people experience the epidemic. I found this webpage called West Coast Leaf, which is a British Columbia-based group that works for equal and just society for all women and people who experience gender-based discrimination. And they mention on their page that the intersections of social location can constrain access to health services, particularly among those negatively impacted by intersecting marginalized forces, e.g. gendered violence, racialization, transphobia. Yet, under the constraints of prohibition, women and gender diverse-focused and culturally responsive harm reduction initiatives continue to remain under-prioritized and underfunded. And even though they're BC-based, I think that we can see that in the United States and many other places as well. And they do mention, too, that women and those who experience multiple intersecting forms of marginalization and discrimination do face these unique and additional barriers, which, you know, I think we all know that, but it's always helpful to read these peer-reviewed studies and articles that mention these difficulties in accessing harm reduction and healthcare services that do exist, if they exist. In a recently published Red Women Rising, women contributors cited a lack of safe consumption sites for Indigenous women, long waitlists for treatment, and a lack of trust in the system as just some of the barriers to accessing healthcare and harm reduction services. So all of this to say is that I think that this book had me reflecting more deeply on the opioid epidemic and the marketing tactics of the pharmaceutical industry and the interconnections and interlocking of wealthy and capitalist mindset in the United States. And it just pulled me in. I mean, like I said in the beginning, this is an extremely large book, but I could not put it down. I mean, I flew through this book. And there are a lot of moments when you listen or read where you will just sit and curse at the book and just be like, of course they did. Of course they did. And it really isn't an easy book to hear or read. And I don't think any of what I'm talking about is easy to hear or read, but it's very important to be aware of. And I am glad that this book exists and that it could kind of open my eyes even more as to the history and how that plays into today and what's going on today with the opioid epidemic. So I certainly encourage you all to take your time with this one. I do think that it's going to be at the very least nominated for a National Book Award this year. So we'll see this year, later this year, if I'm right or wrong. And I just think it's a very powerful book, and it's one that you should, like I said, take your time with. I've said in past podcasts, for those of you who are intimidated by reading such a large nonfiction book, one of the things that I like to do to kind of make that easier is, even if you kind of get yourself to read like 10 pages at a time, that's one of the best strategies, I think. Just challenge yourself to read a few pages. You don't have to read the whole book at a certain time. So I hope that you all take some time for yourself today, and I hope that you all have a wonderful evening.
And I hope that you guys got something out of this and maybe got like a mini history lesson from this segment. Let me know what you think. Even in listening to this, what your reactions are. Feel free to message me. My Instagram handle is @bookedwithemma. I'd love to hear what you guys think, and especially if you do pick up and pick this book up and read it, or if you've already read it, you know, let me know if it blew your mind like it blew my mind. And, you know, the Sacklers. I think I will end on that. Is holy shit, the Sacklers. All right, guys, have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.